My name is John Allen, and I'd like to read you a story that took place within the sound of this great bell. A famous story by the great English writer Charles Dickens, who wrote it over 100 years ago. It has been adapted by J.K. Ross. The illustrations are by Shirley Kaplan. Now, if you'll open your book, I'll begin. Among other public buildings, there is one anciently common to most English towns, great or small, to wit, a workhouse. And in this workhouse was born on a day and date which I need not trouble myself to repeat, the item of mortality whose name was Oliver Twist. As Oliver set up his first loud cry, the patchwork coverlet, which was carelessly flung over the iron bedstead, rustled. The pale face of the young woman who was his mother was raised feebly from the pillow, and a faint voice imperfectly articulated the words, "Let me see the child." The poor young woman stretched out her hand towards the child. She imprinted her cold white lips on its forehead, passed her hands over her face, shuddered, fell back, and died. Where did she come from? "She was brought here last night," replied the old woman attendant. "Where she came from or where she was going to, nobody knows." Oliver was wrapped in old calico robes which had grown yellow. He was badged and ticketed, the orphan of a workhouse, to be cuffed and buffeted through the world. The child Oliver Twist lived for 9 years with Mrs. Mann, who was in charge of the orphanage, where 20 or 30 other little children rolled about the floor all day without the inconvenience of too much food or too much clothing. On Oliver's 9th birthday, Mr. Bumble, the magistrate, came to visit.
"I've come to take Oliver to the workhouse."
And to the workhouse he went. He was taken to a large ward where, on a rough, hard bed, he sobbed and cried himself to sleep. 3 meals of thin gruel were issued daily, with an onion twice a week and half a roll on Sundays. The bowls never needed washing. The boys polished them with their spoons till they shone again. And when they performed this operation, which never took very long, they would sit staring at the copper pot with eager eyes, as if they could have devoured the very bricks on which it cooked. Oliver Twist and his companions suffered slow starvation for 3 months. Lots were cast on who should walk up to the master after supper one evening and ask for more, and it fell to Oliver. Child as he was, desperate with hunger and reckless with misery, he rose from the table and advanced to the master, bowl and spoon in hand, somewhat alarmed at his own temerity. "Please, sir, I want some more." Oliver was ordered into instant confinement, and a bill was next morning posted on the outside of the gate, offering a reward of £5 to anybody who would take Oliver Twist as an apprentice to any trade, business, or calling. A Mr. Sowerberry, tall, gaunt, and attired in a suit of threadbare black, said he would take Oliver and teach him the art of coffin-making and being an undertaker. As Oliver said goodbye to his fellow inmates, he told them, "Now I hope to get some food." At the undertaker's, Oliver's hopes were soon dashed. Mrs. Sowerberry said when she saw him, "I'll give this boy some of the cold bits that were put by for the dog. He hasn't come home since the morning, so he may go without him.
I dare say the boy isn't too dainty to eat him, are you, boy?
Oliver slept under the counter among the coffins. He was awakened early the next morning by Noah Claypole, who worked for the Sowerberrys, and a bully who tormented Oliver. After a month of dog-meat food, coffins, and funerals, one day arrived when Noah Claypole taunted Oliver about his mother, and he goaded him so harshly that Oliver, small as he was, attacked the bully and put him in his place. Mrs. Sowerberry locked Oliver in the dust cellar. Noah rushed to the workhouse where he told Mr. Bumble,
"Oliver, sir, Oliver has turned vicious. He tried to murder me, sir, and the missus has locked him in the dust cellar."
Mr. Bumble knew what was wrong. They had fed Oliver meat. Yes, they had overfed him and raised an artificial soul and spirit in him. "I'll come and fetch him in the morning," he said. But with the first ray of light next day, Oliver fled into the open street, up the hill, and onto the road where he began walking to London. For this 75-mile walk in wintertime, he had a crust of bread, a coarse shirt, and two pairs of stockings in his bundle. Oliver walked and walked for days. Early on the seventh morning, he limped slowly into the little town of Barnet, where he sat, tired to the bone, covered with dust, upon a doorstep. Suddenly, a boy about his own age appeared before him, but one of the queerest-looking boys that Oliver had ever seen. He was a common-faced boy and as dirty a juvenile as one could wish to see, but he had about him all the airs and manners of a man. His hat was stuck on the top of his head so lightly that it threatened to fall off every moment. He wore a man's coat, which reached nearly to his heels. He had turned the cuffs back halfway up his arms to get his hands out of his sleeves. He was altogether as roistering and swaggering a young gentleman as ever stood 4 feet 6. "Hello, my cubby. What's the row?" said this strange young gentleman to Oliver. "I am very hungry and tired," replied Oliver, the tears standing in his eyes as he spoke. His strange friend fed him and introduced himself as Jack Dawkins, and among his intimate friends, he was better known as the Artful Dodger. "I've got to be in London tonight, and I know a 'spectable old gentleman as lives there what'll give you lodgings for nothing, and never ask for the change. That is, if any gentleman he knows introduces you. And don't he know me?" Late that night, they reached London. The Dodger pulled Oliver into a house near Field Lane and closed the door behind them. He took Oliver up a flight of dark and broken stairs and threw open the door of a back room. The walls and ceiling were black with age and dirt. There was a rough wooden table before the fire, upon which were a candle, 2 or 3 pewter pots, a loaf and butter, and a plate. In a frying pan on the fire, some sausages were cooking. And standing over them with a toasting fork in his hand was a very old, shriveled man whose villainous-looking and repulsive face was obscured by a quantity of matted red hair. He was dressed in a greasy flannel gown and seemed to be dividing his attentions between the frying pan and a clothes horse, over which a great number of silk handkerchiefs were hanging. Seated around the table were 4 or 5 boys, none older than Oliver's new friend. These all crowded about their associate as the Dodger whispered a few words to the old man. "This is him, Fagin," he said. "My friend, Oliver Twist." Fagin grinned, and making a low bow to Oliver, took him by the hand and hoped he should have the honor of his intimate acquaintance. "We are glad to see you, Oliver," he said. "Dodger, take off the sausages and draw a chair near the fire for Oliver." Oliver was fed, and soon after was put to bed. It was late next morning when Oliver awoke. He peeked open one eye. There was no other person in the room but old Fagin, who was boiling some coffee in a saucepan for breakfast. Fagin looked at Oliver, called him by name, but Oliver did not answer, and was, to all appearances, asleep. Fagin drew forth from a trap in the floor a small box, which he placed carefully on the table. His eyes glistened as he raised the lid and looked in. He took from it a magnificent gold watch sparkling with jewels. At least half a dozen more were drawn forth, besides rings, brooches, bracelets, and other articles of jewelry that Oliver had no idea even of their names. Suddenly, Fagin realized he was being observed by Oliver. He closed the lid of the box with a loud crash and began angrily questioning and threatening the boy. But Oliver swore that he hadn't seen anything, and Fagin calmed himself. Soon after, the Dodger came home with Charlie Bates. A bit later, the merry old gentleman and the two boys played at a very curious and uncommon game. Fagin, placing a snuff box in one pocket of his trousers, a note case in the other, and a watch in his waistcoat pocket, and putting his spectacle case and handkerchief in the pockets of a coat he buttoned tight around himself, trotted up and down the room with a stick, constantly looking round for fear of thieves, in imitation of the manner in which old gentlemen walk the streets. The two boys followed him closely about, until at last the Dodger trod on his toes or ran upon his boot, while Charlie Bates stumbled up against him behind, and in that one moment they took from him with extraordinary rapidity the entire contents of his pockets. If the old gentleman felt a hand, he cried out where it was, and then the game began all over again. After many days of playing this game himself, Oliver was sent forth under the joint guardianship of Charlie Bates and his friend, the Dodger. They sauntered out and around the city, finally emerging from a narrow court not far from the open square in Clerkenwell. The Dodger made a sudden stop and pointed to an old gentleman standing at a bookstall. "He'll do," said the Dodger. The two boys walked stealthily across the road. Imagine Oliver's horror and alarm as he stood a few paces off to see the Dodger plunge his hand into the old gentleman's pocket and draw from thence a handkerchief, to see him hand the same to Charlie Bates, and finally to behold them both running away around the corner at full speed. In an instant, the whole mystery of the handkerchiefs and the watches and the jewels and Fagin rushed upon the boy's mind. He took to his heels. In the very instant when Oliver began to run, the old gentleman, missing his handkerchief, turned sharp around. Seeing Oliver scudding away at such a rapid pace, he shouted, "Stop thief!" and made off after him, book in hand. The Dodger and Master Bates, hiding in a doorway, heard the cry and issued forth with great promptitude and shouting, "Stop thief!" joined in the pursuit like good citizens. "Stop thief! Stop thief!" Finally, Oliver lay covered with mud and dust and bleeding from the mouth, looking wildly round upon the heap of faces that surrounded him. He was caught. A police officer seized Oliver by the collar and dragged him off to the police magistrate. All the while, a tall and strongly made man lurked nearby. He eyed Oliver carefully, but said not a word. As the police officer dragged Oliver off, he silently followed the Dodger and Master Bates in the opposite direction. The old gentleman whose handkerchief had been stolen and whose name was Mr. Brownlow refused to press charges. The police magistrate ranted and hollered at Oliver. Suddenly the doors burst open and the bookstall keeper entered and proceeded to relate that Oliver had nothing to do with the robbery. Oliver was released, but he was so sick with all that had happened that he could not move. He shivered so with convulsions that Mr. Brownlow called for a coach and took Oliver to a neat house in a quiet, shady street near Pentonville. Here a bed was prepared, and here he was treated with a kindness and solicitude that knew no bounds. A doctor was called, and a motherly old lady called Mrs. Bedwin took care of him. In 3 days' time, he was able to sit in an easy chair, and one day, as he rested, his eyes wandered around the room and finally fixed most intently on a young lady's portrait which hung against the wall just opposite his chair. "It is so very pretty," said Oliver. "The eyes seem fixed on me. It makes my heart beat fast." At that point, Mr. Brownlow looked at the picture and then back to the boy's face, which was its living copy. The eyes, the head, the mouth, every feature was the same. The picture was that of poor young Agnes Fleming, who died in giving birth, wife of Mr. Brownlow's dear friend, Edwin Leaford. But it could have been a picture of Oliver's mother. This incredible thought made Mr. Brownlow utter a sudden, sharp exclamation. But Oliver, knowing not the cause of it, and not being strong enough to bear the start it gave him, fainted away. Now, let us leave Oliver in the safe care of Mrs. Bedwin for a moment at this point in our story, and return to the artful Dodger and Master Bates. After seeing the police officer drag Oliver away, they had returned to Fagin. The noise of footsteps on the creaking stairs roused Fagin, and looking sharply out from under his thick red eyebrows, he bent his ear towards the door and listened. Why, who's this? Only two of them? Where's the third? They can't have got into trouble. The door was slowly opened, and the Dodger and Charlie Bates entered, closing it behind them. Where's Oliver? Said Fagin, rising with a menacing look. Where's the boy? Why, the cops have got him, and that's all about it, said the Dodger sullenly. I'm afraid, said Fagin, that he may say something which will get us into trouble. Suddenly, the tall, lurking man who had witnessed Oliver's arrest appeared in the doorway. Monks! Cried Fagin. Aye, monks, the man said. I've come to talk with ye about that boy, Oliver. Oliver, said Fagin, somebody must find out what's been done at the police office. We must get hold of him somehow. The sudden entrance of two young ladies interrupted Fagin, and he said, The very thing. Nancy will go. Won't you, my dear? Miss Nancy went to the police office where she heard of how Oliver was taken away to somewhere at Pentonville. Meanwhile, Fagin and Monks talked together secretly. When Nancy reported back to Fagin, he said, Find him out, find him out, that's all. We must get the dear boy back to us. We must. Little did Nancy realize that the most amazing conversation had just taken place between Monks and Fagin, in which Monks revealed that Oliver was in truth his long-lost half-brother and legally entitled to the bulk of the estate of their father, who had died some years before. But the will stipulated that in his childhood the younger brother should never have stained his name with any public act of dishonor, meanness, cowardice, or wrong. If this should occur, the whole of the money should then go to Monks. Therefore, a bargain was struck that if Oliver was got back, Fagin should have a certain sum, and he was to have more for making Oliver a thief, driving him through every jail in town, ultimately hauling him up for some capital felony. Now, if you'll turn the record over, I'll continue the story.